As people experience the power of the gospel, their lives are changed. That sets off a chain reaction as other lives are touched. We've seen this happen as each day more and more lives are changed here in RDU and throughout the world. As Christ's body in our community, we have the power to bless RDU and the world by demonstrating the love of Christ. By demonstrating His love and mercy to those around us, Jesus is being made known. The church is God's plan for changing individual lives and whole communities. By planting churches here and beyond, we will see the gospel spread beyond our wildest imaginations. Our vision is to plant 1,000 churches in the next 40 years. This is our vision, and this is our mission. Mission expansion is another step of faith in our journey. The summit took a step in January of 2002 when 350 people set a goal to reach 1,000 by Easter. Another step was taken in 2004 by pledging and giving $2.8 million to a relocation project. Other steps have been selling our first building and moving into a high school, buying land across town, and becoming a multi-site church. At the start of 2009, the summit had 4 campuses, and in the fall we launched our first Spanish-speaking campus, Summit in Español. Now it is time for us to take another step, one that will lay the foundation for future expansion of the mission throughout RDU and to the ends of the earth. One word unlocks the power needed for this step: believe. It is a command. It is a calling. It is simple obedience. We believe because God is able. So what is mission expansion? It is the Summit Church fulfilling its purpose to reach out to the community with the love of Jesus Christ.
Well, good morning. I want to welcome you here to the Summit Church, whatever campus you join us from. Last week we finished up the Still Standing series, and next week we are going to begin a series from the latter part of the book of Exodus called Presence. And so I thought I would take a little of the in-between time, which is this week. You see, we have grown by nearly 1,000 people in the last 12 months, and that means a lot of you are new and may not really understand what's going on around here, and I thought it would be a good idea to take a moment to review who we are and where we are going. If you have your Bible, open it up to Luke chapter 14. I think that's where it'd be most helpful for you to have open and have on your lap there. Who we are and where we are going. My best friend, a guy named Bruce Ashford, who is a member of our church here, told me a story about a kid at his high school named Gene. Gene was 6'6". Bruce said he was tall, but he wasn't exactly the kind of guy you would call coordinated. In fact, he said that Gene, you know, the proverbial story of the guy who walks into the lunchroom and trips over his own 2 feet and drops his stuff into the trash can, he said that literally happened to Gene. He said that's not, it just happened. But, you know, size, of course, is a big deal in basketball, so Gene was the backup center. Bruce told me that their senior year, their team had made it to the championship game of some tournament they were playing in. Well, with 8 seconds left to go on the clock, the starting center fouled out. All right, their starting center. 8 seconds left to go on the clock. They were down by one. The other team gets the ball and is going to inbound it from midcourt. And guess who the coach puts in? That's right, Gene. All right, so the other team inbounds the ball. Somebody tips it. There's a skirmish, bodies flying everywhere, hands and legs and arms. And guess who ends up with the ball? Gene. Yes, Gene ends up with the ball, and he grabs it, and with 8 seconds left to go on the clock, he sees his moment, and he takes off toward the basket. He outruns everybody. He goes up to that basket, and in a moment of glory, just pulls that thing back and all his 6'6"-ness, tomahawks it, you know, and just hammers it right into that basket, you know, hangs on the rim for a minute and, you know, points at people and just throws it down in the wrong goal. So instead of losing by one, they lost by three in that game. So the moral of the story is every once in a while, you need to stop and make sure that you're going the right direction, okay? So I want us to do that as a church, and I want us to do so by means of a statement by Jesus that I've been studying a lot personally that I think speaks to this issue for us now. Now, I will tell you in advance that it is one of the most difficult statements that Jesus ever made about being his disciple. And that's who we are, by the way. That's what every Christian is a disciple of Jesus, no exceptions. And there are some really difficult things that Jesus says about disciples in here that are hard for us to hear, honestly, but that we really need to hear. For me, I will tell you, this passage is kind of like hard candy. If you try just to crunch down on it, it might break your teeth. But if you spend some time with it, if you let it work on you for a while, you'll find that there's some great stuff in there. So we're going to try to take this passage apart and then reflect on what it means for who we are as a church and where we are going and where you specifically are going in your life. Verse 25. Now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and his wife and his children and his brothers and his sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Now, what on earth does he mean by this? There's a phrase in there, at least one, that trips everybody up. Hates your father and mother. For some of you, that statement seems absurd. You're like, hates your father and mother? What? I mean, what's that all about? For others of you, that statement is unnecessary because you're like, I already hate my mom and my dad, you know? So what is that about? What did Jesus mean by this? Well, nobody really thinks that Jesus means hate in the sense that you should curse them. After all, Jesus taught us to love all people, including our enemies. And it has been the experience of countless people down through the last 2,000 years that when you begin to really follow Jesus, you start to love your family and your wife and your children more, not less. So nobody really thinks that what he meant here was that you should make an exception with your parents and start to hate them. Now, I would say instinctively, you probably know what he means here. He's drawing a comparison between our love for him and our love for everything else. Let me use an example from the Bible, because the best way to interpret the Bible is always the Bible. In the book of Genesis, there's a story of a guy named Laban who has two daughters, Leah and Rachel. Evidently, Rachel was incredibly beautiful, and so this guy named Jacob wanted to marry her, Rachel. But Leah was older, and so Laban, the dad, wanted Jacob to marry Leah instead. So Laban agrees to let Jacob marry Rachel, the younger, the hot one, right, if he'll work 7 years of slave labor for him. And so Jacob agrees, because he's so in love with Rachel. But on the night of the wedding, Laban puts a little Jack Daniels in the pre-wedding punch, and he tricks Jacob into marrying and sleeping with Leah instead. All right, well, Jacob wakes up the next morning, he sobers up, and of course he's angry. And I know some of you are like, well, this sounds like an Old Testament Jerry Springer show. It really does, all right? But that's what, you know, he gets up, well, what's done is done, right? And so he's married to Leah now, but he's so in love with Rachel that he agrees to work another 7 years for her, which had, by the way, to make things awkward in the house with Leah. Right? How was work today, honey? How was work today? Tough, but one day closer to the new and improved you. You know, it had to be awkward, right? Now, Jacob was so in love with Rachel that it says in Genesis that all those 14 years of slave labor were to him like, here's the little phrase, just a day. He was so enthralled with Rachel, it just went by. It doesn't mean, right? Oh, by the way, another little phrase in here. It says that Jacob hated Leah and loved Rachel. It's literally what it says in Hebrew. And what it means by that is not that he bore any disgust or ill will toward Leah, just that he was so much more enthralled with Rachel and driven by her that in comparison to her, what he felt for Leah was like hate. He prioritized Rachel, the possession above Rachel, above everything, and would do absolutely anything to possess her. Now, if you've ever really fallen in love with somebody, you know what this is like, right? When I fell in love with Veronica, it's not that I started to hate or dislike other girls, just that they didn't move me anymore. I had the Ferrari of women. I didn't need all the other models, right? Right? You're so enthralled with one that what you feel for the others becomes something much different. That's what it means to be with Jesus. He is the one thing you must desire to possess above all else. Your commitment to Him is so absolute that compared to it, your commitment to everything else, even great things like family, looks like hate. By the way, do you ever think about the audacity of that statement for Him to make? Every once in a while you find somebody's like, well, Jesus never really claimed to be God. How on earth could you make a statement like that and not be God? Right? Oh, I want you to forsake everything. And I want you to turn from your family. I want you to love me so much that compared to your love of me, everything else looks like hate. Only God can make a statement like that. All right, but that's what the first thing about discipleship, about who we are, that I want you to get your mind around. And that's this. Number one, discipleship is total. Discipleship is total. There is nothing, absolutely nothing in your life that comes before Him. Not even great and important things like your father, your mother, your children. Not your dreams, not your desires, not your plans for the future. Nothing. You see, a lot of people come to Jesus as a way of getting a better family. You know, at some point in your life, usually around the birth of your first child, a lot of people start to decide that God should be a part of their lives. I know many of you, this is when you started to come back to church. You're like, God needs to be a part of my life. Or maybe you lack purpose. Maybe you lack friends. Maybe you needed help in your marriage. Maybe you started to worry about what was going to happen to you when you died. And so you came back to church. Jesus for you became a means to an end. Right? A means to a good life. The better life now. The assured life. The peaceful life. But Jesus, what He's showing you is He's not a means to anything. He is the end itself. Some commentators point out that in verse 26, Jesus is walking people through a Jewish life progression. Father and mother, then wife, then children, then brothers and sisters. And He's saying you must love Him supremely to all of those things. You do not acquire Jesus to get a better family, to get more purpose, to get power. You use instead every part of your life to try and get more of Him. And if you ever have to choose between obeying Him or serving and possessing or being close to those things, you always choose obedience to Jesus. I read a biography not too long ago of John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress. John Bunyan lived at a time in England when it was illegal to preach the gospel because it was against the official state church religion. And so John Bunyan went right on preaching the gospel because he knew that was his duty as a believer. And so the authorities took him and put him in prison and told him he could not get out so long as he preached the gospel. So they let him out, and he went out and he preached the gospel again. They put him back in there. And they said, if you will swear to us you will not preach the gospel, we will let you go free. And Bunyan said, I can never make that promise because I must always preach the gospel. And Bunyan, in his biography, his autobiography, records, because his family was very poor, even before he went to prison, and then now that he was in prison, they were especially poor. And he said, just the weight of what it means to be apart from my family. He had one, by the way, little blind child. He said it was especially difficult for him to watch her suffer because of his obedience to God. He said being in prison was like pulling the flesh off of his bones. Not just because he missed his family, but because he knew that his obedience was costing them as well. And then he made this statement in there. I'll never forget the last little phrase. He says, but I know that I must obey Christ. I know that I must obey Christ, and ultimately it's better for them if I obey Christ as well. You see, I know that your situation may be different, but for all of us, Christ is supreme. He is above and more important and is prioritized above every relationship. When I first sensed that God was calling me into the ministry, specifically to go overseas, I was afraid of what my parents were going to say. In retrospect now, I see it's kind of silly because they always wanted me to do just whatever God wanted me to do. But I was afraid because they've been paying for me to go to college and to go to law school. And they kind of had a plan for how they thought my life was going to turn out. And it looked like God was taking me a place that they didn't think that I was going. And I remember the night that I went to tell them. And I was afraid because I thought they were going to look at me in the face and say, you can't do it. You cannot go throw away your education and your life going into ministry. You certainly can't do it overseas. And I remember the feeling as I drove to meet them of saying, but if they say that, I've got to look back at them and say, I love you. I want to honor you. I don't want to disappoint you, but I have to put Jesus first, even above you. And again, in retrospect, they were thrilled with it. But the point is, you can't come to Jesus with any ifs, any conditions, any exceptions. Discipleship is total. Nothing can come before Jesus. The other image he used by here is the one of the cross. Think about what the cross meant to the people that were hearing that. A man carrying a cross was a condemned criminal. He was under a sentence of death. He was under arrest. He was no longer free to do what he wanted. A man carrying a cross couldn't say, you know, this really isn't working for me anymore. At first, I thought this was going to be purifying, kind of a good experience, but man, I'm totally done with this. Now, you were under arrest. You were under arrest. Discipleship is total. You were under arrest so that everything is now subject to Jesus. I remember when I went through driver's ed. How many of you did driver's ed when you were 15 or 16 or 28 years old? Anybody? All right, so driver's ed, I was 15 years old, and I remember the car. I don't know if they still do this, but I drove around a little Chevy Nova. And it was, you know, very unusual Chevy Nova because, A, it had, I think, three pistons in it total. And I had a little steering wheel and, you know, all the controls. But on the side where the tutor sat, there was another little steering wheel that overrode my steering wheel. I don't know how that worked. And then he had a brake pedal that came out of the floor that just stopped everything. Right? So I'd go turning down some street and do something wrong, and he would, like, we all slam and whiplash because no matter what I wanted to do, like, he could always override it. Now, who was in charge of the car? Well, in a sense, you'd think I was, right? Because I was the one driving, but really, he could override it anytime he wanted. Here's the question. I know many of you allow Jesus to be an influence in your life, and you allow him to make some suggestions, and you were following a part of his plan for your life, but does he have full control, or do you still have the brake pedal? Who owns the brake pedal in your life? There can be no partial surrender to his authority. He is the king. He is the absolute monarch. He doesn't come to be a good influence on you. He comes to be your master. Many people in our culture want a meek and mild Jesus who carries our burdens and comforts us and helps us be moral, good people. But Jesus does not say, take up my teachings or take up my moral code. He says, take up my cross. He does not call us to moralism. He does not call us to a spiritual makeover. He calls us to absolute surrender. He is the king. Have you ever come to him this way? You see, in our culture, we preach a false discipleship, and that is, oh, you should accept Jesus as your Savior. He'll help you out in a jam. He'll take you to heaven. One day, maybe you can mature into obedience. One day, maybe. But for now, just come to him and get all your burdens relieved. That does not exist. It's made up, totally. Here's number two. Discipleship is emotional. Here is the thing that strikes me about this passage. Jesus could have made the point that he was to be fully in charge using different words, couldn't he? He could have said, hey, I got to be the most important, or I got to be supreme, or I got to be the trump card. But he chose to put the question in terms of love and hate. And that is because real Christian discipleship is not begrudging duty to Jesus. Real Christianity is emotional. The highest of your affections and your passions are for him. That's why I used Rachel as an example. Because what you've got there is you've got not duty, you've got passion. I say this because a lot of people's relationships to Jesus is very mechanical, especially here in the South, very duty-oriented. And they feel like because they live a certain way and do certain things that everything is okay. But that is not Christianity. God would not want begrudging obedience any more than a wife would. I mean, if I took my wife out for a special dinner, and I took her to a favorite restaurant, I arranged for childcare, which seems to be how I most communicate love now, all right? So I arranged for childcare, bought her a necklace, flowers, a new dress, and sitting over dinner at her favorite restaurant, she looks back at me and she says, why? What is all this for? You know, and I say, well, two reasons, really. A, there are some things I really need from you. And I figure that you won't do those unless I do junk like this, okay? And B, I really want the reputation of being a good husband. And on the manual for good husbands on page 53, paragraph 6, it says that every 6 months, I need to do something like this. So honestly, there's a lot of other stuff I would rather be doing tonight, but duty calls. In fact, to be totally honest, there's a lot of other girls I'd rather be here with, but good husbands don't cheat, so I'm here with you. Now, what do you think she says back to that? Wow, what a great husband. I'm so grateful for you. Of course not. Begrudging obedience, why would God be different? Paul said it this way, I could give up my body to be burned, but if I don't have love, it doesn't make any difference to God. You see, what Jesus did for you was deeply emotional. He wept over you. He bled for you. He loved you to a depth that you have never been loved. And His desire is not to constrain you with rules, but for you to love Him in return more than anything. The Jesus who is saying to you, follow me, is the Jesus who poured out absolutely everything for you. You see, I struggled a little with this, wondering how those of you in here this morning whom life has really beat up recently, and you come into our church with pain, right, and you're looking for a word of hope, and I thought, how would you hear this? You come in needing a word of hope, and then I give you this, and you're like, this is not helping, but listen, it really does. Because this whole passage means that when you really know Christ, when you see Him, you see that He is worth infinitely more than fathers and mothers and wives and even your own life. And so when you lose those things, health, relationships, a job, you have in Christ something of so much greater value, something so more deeply satisfying than all those things. And if you've had to let go of those things this morning, you can rejoice that you possess an even greater treasure in Him. It's emotional. Here is number three. It is sacrificial. Discipleship is sacrificial. Jesus said, verse 27, if you follow me, you got to take up your cross. Now you realize that the cross was about more than simple obedience and rule keeping for Jesus. It was an act of sacrifice. Jesus going to the cross was simply not obeying God. It was that, but it was more than that. He was pouring His life out for us. He was loving us. He was saving us. And so when He says, those who follow me will take up their cross, it means, listen, that they will live with personal sacrifice the way that He lived. This is pretty staggering when you think of what it must have been like for the audience who first heard this. For them, the cross was not a pretty piece of jewelry or a sentimental symbol of their faith. It was an instrument of oppression and torture and execution. It was ludicrous for Him to say this. As far as to try to get followers. I mean, imagine a politician trying to use this line today. Come join my party. Strap yourself to the electric chair and let's go. Blindfold yourself and wait for the crack of bullets that will slice through your chest and end your life. Yes, you can. Right? This is death you can't believe in. It totally would not work. But to follow Jesus means that your life is characterized like His. By radical commitment to His mission. Radical generosity toward others that need what His mission offers them. You see, as I said a moment ago, for most Americans, Jesus is something that simply adds value to their lives. He adds meaning. He adds fulfillment. He adds purpose. Now, we know people in that category, they know that Jesus, you know, requires certain things. You got to tithe your money. You got to volunteer at your church. You got to come to His house, the church, fairly often. But those things are kind of like a tax that Jesus requires. And if you keep the tax paid off, then you can go on about your life. I mean, think about how most of us look at taxes. A tax is what you pay to Uncle Sam so you can go on with your life. It's your civic duty. Very few of us in here, maybe a few, but very few of us, live for and love the government so much that we just wipe away our tears as we pay our taxes, thanking the sweet IRS for a chance to be involved in this great pursuit, right? But we just know that good Americans pay their taxes, and if not, they go to jail, right? In the same way, we know that good Christians, they got their taxes, they got to tithe, they got to live morally, got to come to church, and these are what you do to pay your taxes to Jesus so He will bless you as you pursue your real goals and dreams. See, Jesus is talking about something altogether different. He's talking about a life that is spent pouring itself out for others. In fact, he gave you a great example of what He meant by that. Back in verse 12, earlier in the chapter, jump back with your eyes there for a minute. He said also to the man who had invited Him, right? This is the guy that invited Jesus over for dinner because he thought that Jesus was pretty influential and it'd be cool if Jesus came to his house because that would make him look cool in everybody's eyes. Jesus goes down for worst and rudest guest ever, ever, ever in history when He says this. And then verse 12, when you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors or really important people like me, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. No, instead, when you give a feast, you should invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you'll be blessed because they can't repay you. You'll be repaid at the resurrection of the just. What he's saying is, if you're going to be my disciple, most of your parties will be for people who cannot pay you back. Your whole life will not be a gradual progression toward more and better stuff. Your whole life will be poured out and a progression toward greater and more meaningful service. You don't ask, how much do I have to give to keep God off my back? You will be asking, how can I more greatly impact the kingdom? How can I give away more for the kingdom to people who can never pay me back and don't add anything to my life at all? You know, I've really struggled with this point personally, because most of us, as we get older, we increase in our net worth. Right? We drive nicer cars, we live in nicer houses, we got a little more in savings. When I graduated from seminary, like everybody else, I was dirt poor. We lived paycheck to paycheck. You know, going out to eat for us meant hitting up the Hardee's once a month and getting a Frisco burger, and that was it. Right? Well, now we live in a nicer house, I'm more established. I got a little bit more in savings. And there are places in the Bible that talk about how God blesses you and He rewards you and He prospers you. Right? And the book of Proverbs that we just studied even says that wise people can build wealth. So I know that's not altogether wrong. But at the same time, I know that following Jesus means living like He lived. And He didn't just pursue His dreams. He gave Himself at the cross for us. So what does that mean for us to follow Him? Honestly, I'm not totally sure yet. I mean, I feel like Veronica and I are on a journey ourselves with this. But I know at least this. I know that it means that we run our entire lives through the grid of what is best for Jesus' kingdom. In fact, an analogy I've used before that's helpful for me is thinking of your life like a movie. When you think of a movie, in a movie you've always got major characters and minor characters, right? And what happens to the minor characters is inconsequential. It's what happens to the major character. In fact, the minor characters exist for the major character, right? I mean, you think about, like, greatest movie of all time, at least in the 1980s, what was it? That's right, Top Gun, okay? So Top Gun, who's the major character in Top Gun? Tom Cruise. Maverick, who's the minor character? Goose. Now, Goose is actually a much better character, much more likable. But his whole point in the movie is to die so that you'll feel sorry for Tom Cruise. That's his whole role. A minor character, what happens to them is inconsequential because the movie's about the main character. You see, in most of your lives, we have lived as if we were the main character in our lives. So everything that comes into the movie of our lives is designed for the plot of how things turn out for us. But to follow Jesus means that you cease to be the main character and you become a minor character in a movie about Him. And you begin to realize that the point in your life is not living and dying and getting lots of things. The point is how it progresses the plot that He is producing. This is completely the opposite of all you hear in your culture. Right? This is different than what you heard at your graduation speech, what your valedictorian said. It's different than what Oprah said when she came here to Duke last year, I guarantee you. Well, what they tell you is it's about you and your dreams. Make the most of your movie. You only get one shot. Carrying the cross means you play a role in a movie not about you at all. The cross. Remember the first time I saw a sacrifice, I've told you this, it was in a Muslim country. I'll never forget this. It was the most hideous thing I've ever seen. And some of you will just, this will be difficult for you to hear, but I don't say it for shock value. It's when they sacrificed a bull, and I was about 5 feet from where they did it. And I stood there, and it took 7 men to hold this bull down as this priest began to just cut through the neck of this bull. And when they cut through those arteries, blood just spewed. I mean, it was disgusting, just covered me head to toe with the blood. And then that thing, as it tried to breathe and it tried to struggle, it just kicked, and all 7 men held it down, and it gasped and it wheezed. And for about 45 seconds, it struggled to live, and then it died. And I realized probably at no point in my life had I ever understood as clearly what Jesus must have meant when He said, you want to follow Me, you take up your cross, and you become a living sacrifice. Let's be honest, who's ready for that to be the picture of their life? You see what I'm getting at? What Jesus is talking about is different. Carrying your cross means that you are dead to all the dreams. Listen, carrying your cross means that you are dead to all the dreams you have for yourself. It means that He is fully in charge of your life. You're like a man with a cross under a death sentence with no more rights and demands. Jesus decides where you live. Jesus decides where you work, what kind of car you'll drive, what kind of clothes you'll wear. He decides where you'll live and what you'll do with your profession. Have you ever done that and given Him that kind of control of your life? You know, for some of you, that's going to mean that you do what Curtis Allen here at our church did a few years ago, now on our staff, but he was a corporate executive of a very large RTP software company here. I'm making a great salary, a place that many of us would love to end up. But as it settled into him what it meant for people around the world to have had no access to Jesus, for people to be dying around with not access to food and clean water and those kind of things, he resigns from that and goes as one of our church planters with his wife and his two teenage children. And every time people hear about that, they kind of like, ooh, two teenagers and living and leaving the high salary and carry and going over to, you know, why is that the exception? You know, with 4 billion people on the earth with little to no access to the gospel, with 30,000 kids dying today of either hunger or preventable diseases, why is that such the exception? Doesn't Jesus love those people as much as He loves your own children? How can we say we carry the cross and that story not be much more common? For some of you, that may not mean that you go yourself, but it means that you begin to radically increase your giving. Where is the family that downsizes its home so that it can give more to the mission of God? Or drives a used car when they can have a new one? Or scales back their vacations so they can invest more in mission? You know, Long Beach, California, there's a boat that is harbored off the shore there. It's called the Queen Mary. It was built in the early 20th century as a high-end cruise liner. It was huge. It could accommodate, bigger than the Titanic, could accommodate 3,000 luxury guests with all the amenities designed to appeal to the highest level of clientele. Well, when Great Britain went to war in World War II, it was turned into a transport for troops. It was re-engineered so that it can now accommodate 15,000 troops. And it's now a museum out in California. You can go into it and see a comparison of what it looked like as a luxury ship and what it looked like when it was engineered for mission. Here's a question. Which one does our lives look like? Most of us have taken God's blessings and just seem to forget there is a mission of eternal importance out there. And we keep living on the Queen Mary like it's luxury for us. And that is not okay. It is not okay. You cannot say you carry the cross and live like that. You see what I'm getting at? You see why this is so unpopular? You see why everybody left Jesus when he was talking about it? You see, the gospel is only good news to people if it gets there in time. And the only way it gets there in time is when we radically get committed to it. We're the ones that make that happen. It means for some of you that when you make job decisions, right, you have different questions besides just where you're going to make the most money. You're going to ask, where can you serve God the best? For some of you students, it means you got to reevaluate your life goals in light of what is best for God's kingdom. Because up until now, it's just been, what about your life goals and what do you want to do? It's got to be about the kingdom of God. Here's number 4. Discipleship is not optional. A lot of people hear this and they say, well, this is like for super Christians. This is like varsity. Right? You know, just about everybody thinks there are two classes of Christians. You got your regular run-of-the-mill Christian, and then you got your really devoted followers, but that stratification does not exist in Jesus' mind. Notice verse 25. This is what he is saying to the crowds who are just starting to follow him. This is his new recruit speech. This is not the fine print, right? You know, fine print, like at a hotel. Just tick anybody else off. You go check into a hotel, $88 a night. You check out the next morning, you owe $148. It said $88 a night. Oh, but there's a shower drain fee, right? There's a vanity tax for looking in the mirror twice. It all adds up to $148. It's right here. Fine print. This is not the fine print. This is right up front. He's saying, if you're going to follow me, you need to think about this. We present the gospel in our culture like it's, hey, everybody, Jesus really needs followers. Please, do him a favor. Do us a favor. Join, please. And Jesus is saying, actually, I don't really need followers that bad. I mean, I want to save you, yeah. But you don't come to God on your terms. You come on His. And if you're going to come, this is how you come. I don't need you. You need me. And let's make sure we keep that clear. I get the image this week, like one of those Marines commercials. You ever watch those things? Just about every guy I know would have liked to have been a Marine. Right? Just most of us, including me. I want to do. I'd love to be a Marine. Then I noticed that in every commercial for the Marines, they were running. Always running. And I hate running. I mean, if I'm going to run, give me a ball to dribble or something to kick or somebody to run into, but I just don't want to go run. No offense to all you guys that enjoy doing that, but I don't like it, all right? But you know, that commercial lets me know something, and that is if you're going to be a Marine, you're going to be doing some running. I mean, imagine showing up at boot camp and being like, yeah, I'm not really into running, you know? Well, you guys are running. I'll be over here with my Diet Coke and my box of Krispy Kremes. If you could just let me know when it's time to put on those snappy uniforms and get the bayonet, those are awesome, but not the running. All right. Jesus doesn't pull back. Listen, He doesn't need you as a follower. He really doesn't. He is the God of the universe. He wants to save you, but He is the King. So He concludes this little like talk He gives through. Therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It's thrown away. How's that for an insult? You half-committed people, you're not even fit for the manure pile. You'd ruin dung. That's taking it to a whole new level. Can I make it any clearer? The mission that Jesus is on, the mission He has called our church to, is too important for half-committed people. He is counseling against hasty emotional decisions. Jesus did not come to build an audience. He came to call radically committed followers. Before I get to what that means for us as a church, let me just ask you a question. Have you ever really come to Jesus on His terms? Given Him total control and said, I live for your mission entirely. Because again, in our culture, especially the South, we preach to Jesus who will save you, but for whom obedience and reorientation of your life goals and radical sacrifice for His kingdom are optional. But for the real Jesus, they are not. And the tragedy is that it's kept some of you deluded into thinking that you got the real thing. I know this turns some of you off. I know when Jesus preached this, a bunch of people didn't come back. And see, what my prayer is today is that the only way that you can do this is if you open your eyes, or if God opens your eyes to see the real value of what Jesus is. And when you see the value that He is, suddenly you see that this kind of obedience is not what you were compelled to do, but it's what you desire to do. See, God opened their eyes to let them see the value of Jesus. Now, I told you I wanted us to think about this specifically in relation to where we are going as a church. It always put a clock right there. It tells me how much time I have left. It said zero the entire time. I'm not sure if that means I've never had any time from the time I started or how much I've got left. I'm going to assume I got like a full 30 minutes, okay? So until you put the right time right there, that's what I'm going off of. Let me walk you through this really quickly. Our goals as a church, let me tell you what this means for us. We want to radically extend ourselves to reach our community. This church is in the middle of what we call a mission expansion project called Believe, where we are trying to increase our capacity to reach people. Now, we call this a mission expansion project because the point is not building a building. The point is expanding our mission to reach our community, and buildings are just tools to help us do that. You see, this passage means that our mission cannot be simply to build a great, beautiful building with a bunch of amenities for Christians, like a Christian club or something, like Bible Town or Six Flags Over Jesus or whatever you want to call it, all right? No, we got a mission that is too important for us to bury our money in buildings and luxuries for ourselves. We want Queen Mary the missional ship, not Queen Mary the luxury ship. And we want only enough building for us to get the job done. You see, buildings for us are tools. Right? We have this principle around here we say a lot to each other. We call it the good enough principle. And that means for a lot of our stuff, we're like, yeah, it could be a lot nicer. But it's, you know, a lot nicer than it is, but it's good enough to get the job done. Or it's another way we say this is ghetto is one of our values. Right? It's okay. We are okay because it's missional. We know that to reach people here, we need a basic building. It's got to be safe. It's got to be functional. You know, people don't want to drop their kids off in an unsafe environment, a construction zone or whatever. And so we need a place that is safe and functional. And that's what we want to use our money to build, not a bunch of luxuries for Christians. So our Believe project is not about building beautiful monuments. We need to build a place right here in Briar Creek. We're renting the place where I'm standing now. And we want to be able to open some new campuses in some part of Raleigh and Durham that don't really have the kind of presence for Christ. Right? That's what it means for us. That's what we got to be committed to. This passage also means for us as a church that we give away a significant portion of our income to the poor and to the unreached. Y'all, right now we give away about 20% of our income to ministries that reach lost people and take care of the poor outside of our church. That doesn't include a lot of the ones we run right here within our church. Because that's really important to us. Because we don't exist just to pamper ourselves with our own money and call that ministry. We want to partner with you and your family, but we realize that Raleigh-Durham is a city of haves and have-nots. And church buildings litter the landscape of the haves. While many of the have-nots sit outside of that with nothing, and that's not okay. You've been doing that for the last 4 or 5 years. I got an article I saw this week, and I won't read it to you. But it was a story about how one of the schools we've adopted, Eastway Elementary, how just now after being involved with them for several years, how they feel about us. It was awesome. You got to get this article and read it. You can link to it off our website. And it talked about how, you know, we've adopted some of their children in the sense that we've, you know, helped educationally adopted them, how we've just got involved with their families and their teachers. And the school principal stood up at sort of an appreciation thing a few weeks ago and to all of her teachers says, you know, in the last few years, our relationship with the Summit has gone more from partnership to friendship. And the newspaper reporter said almost in unison, all the teachers shouted back, no, family. They're like family to us. Another school here in the area, we approached them about getting involved with them, and they didn't really want to have anything to do with it because we're a church and churches are weird. And until they heard the name, and I say this not for the glory of our name, but just until they heard it, oh, y'all are the Summit Church? Can y'all hear what y'all did at Eastway? Because that was awesome. And they opened the door for us to be able to come in. See, that's really, really important to us because we are here to bless our city and to give away ourselves into doing that. That's what Raleigh-Durham needs. In a city of haves and have-nots, what they don't need is a beautiful monument. I think what they need is to see that Christianity is not about stuff. Then you see about a God who is more valuable than stuff. We need to communicate to them that there is a God that we desperately need more than stuff. And our God doesn't exist to pamper our lives here on earth. Our God is a God who cares about them. It means for us, we want to send out church planting teams to places around the world that have no access to the gospel. That's why our mission is to plant 1,000 churches in the next 40 years. In the last 7 years, we've been a significant part of 4 North American church plants. One in New York City, one in Richmond, Virginia, one in Youngstown, Ohio, and one in Greenville, North Carolina. That's why we say at our church, we don't just measure our success by our seating capacity. We measure our success also by our sending capacity. Because we know that's what the carrying the cross means for us as a church. It forms our mission. See? Here's what it means for me personally. As I think through this, it means as a pastor, it means I got to teach the Bible fearlessly. And call people to discipleship even when it ticks them off and makes them leave. A lot of pastors, a lot of us, get our validation by the size of our audience and not from our calling by God. And when that happens, when you get validated in ministry by the size of your audience, mark it down, you will compromise the message because you don't want people to leave. Jesus didn't care about losing the audience. He was fine with everybody leaving. He really was. And you guys need me to be willing to preach texts like this one and be willing for people not to come back. Jesus was the greatest teacher who ever lived. How do you know that? Thousands of people flocked to hear him speak. Plus, he could do miracles. Don't you find it odd that when he died, get this, don't you find it odd that when he died, he had 120 people that were his followers and that was it? You want to know why? Sermons like this one is why. You see? He preached in a way that said, I'm not interested in all the half committed. So when he died, there was 120 people left, but those 120 people changed the world. I got one clarification here. I know a lot of you in here are spiritual seekers. I mean, I'll call you that. You're not really sure who Jesus is, and I don't want you to hear this and say, are you telling me to leave? No, I'm not telling you to leave, nor was Jesus. Right? You stay as long as you need here to figure out who Jesus is, and you investigate it. I want you to do it in a way that is not threatening. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking about people who know that Jesus is Lord, but just want to accessorize their lives with Him rather than really follow Him in total, emotional, sacrificial surrender. You see? The other thing this passage means for me is that I got to be one of you. Jesus calls me to carry the cross and pour my life out too. You see, some pastors can tend to become kings at their churches. There's nothing worse than a pastor who is a king. Absolute power corrupts in whatever context. I am part of a leadership team here, right? And I lose votes sometimes. Now, I'm always right, all right? And after like 2 years, I'm like, see, I told you guys, you know, but I'm not the king. And it means that I serve and I sacrifice like everybody else. And that means I need to live my life and throw my parties for people who can't pay me back either. This whole thing can't be about a big old party that I benefit from. Carrying the cross is for me. Here's what it means for you. It means you got to get off the sidelines and get involved. Jesus did not die to create an audience of half-committed sideline sitters. Churches that are filled with half-committed sideline sitters, he doesn't even think are fit for manure piles. And before I became a pastor, I traveled a lot and I spoke to different groups. I quit doing that because, honestly, I hated the audiences of people who would just sit and just listen. Not that I mean, I didn't hate them. I just hated an audience that, you know, you just like, I preach and I show up and I'm the entertainment and for God, and then I left. Yeah, and there's a place for that, I know, but I knew God had called me to lead and develop a group of disciples, not create an audience. Now, here we are. And there's like between 3,000 and 4,000 people here on Sundays. Upwards of 4,000. About half of you are covenant members. I'm going to assume the other 2,000 of you are kind of here checking things out, and that's okay, all right? But of the 2,000 that are our covenant members, about 40% of you are in a small group. I'm not even talking about the other 2,000. I'm saying 40% of you that are our covenant members. Only 40% are in some kind of group. About a third of you volunteer in ministry in our church. About half of you, of those covenant members, give in a way that shows you are invested in this church. You see what that means for me? It means I'm back to the group. I'm back to the audience. And that is not what God has called me to do. Summon, I want you to realize that God has blessed us. I talked with a Muslim girl a couple weeks ago. She's probably here this morning. Right? She came to Christ, baptized her back in March. Right? She's a student at Duke. I said, how'd you come to Christ? She said, because one of your members would not let it go. And brought me and invited me. So I got a letter from an atheist who talked about how he came here and was so skeptical and how God used everything from the ministry of how he was greeted here to how people treated him to come to Christ. I got a letter from a couple who said, and I quote, it's been a painful process when I was lost and burned out by religion. I had nothing, wanted nothing to do with God. But she says, now I've been healed. And the Summit Church has shown me a side of Christianity I'd never known. Never have I experienced the love and the balance and the patience and the pursuit of only Jesus the way that I have here. We have a Hispanic campus that's begun. It's reaching a whole new segment. We reached over 1,000 new people in the last year. 2 weeks ago, we had 250 people jammed into the bay, investigating a call to church planting Summit. God is blessing us because of the sacrifice of a number of you. But now what I'm telling you is it's time for the rest of you to get involved. In light of this passage, it is not okay for you to be a spectator. We need you to help. We got needs in our student ministry. We got needs with our children. Greeting. We need you to be a part of this. Let me tell you exactly where we are. We started this Believe Project earlier this year. You know, many of our people just gave extraordinarily. Since then, we've been able to open up this Hispanic campus, open up another campus or open up another service there at West Club. Now we're looking into buying either this place where I'm standing right now or trying to build right down the road. That decision is fairly imminent. We got a couple of things we've got to work out, but that will be coming out with that soon. We got some upgrades to do at various of our campuses. We need to start some new campuses. And a lot of you are involved, and I want to thank you, and I want to encourage you to keep going because we just started this thing, and I want the rest of you now to join up with it too. I want you to join and be a part. I want you to financially invest yourself here in our mission, because to expand our mission, to send people out to these places, let's just be honest, it takes resources. And that means some of us have to choose to live like Paul, content with a simple life rather than a luxurious one. We got to live on Queen Mary, the missional ship, and not Queen Mary, the luxury ship, the troop transport, because we recognize there is a mission. And I want you to invite you to go through this Luke 14 passage and to quit being a spectator and a fan and become a disciple. Let me get you, here's what I'm going to have you do. I'm going to have you bow your heads at all of our campuses. I'm going to pray for us. And then our campus pastors at our various campuses are going to come up and they're going to give us instructions about what we need to do. Father, my prayer has been that you would open the eyes to let us see the value of Jesus, so that our response would not be like a sacrifice. Our response would be grateful, that we would want to love others the way that we have been loved. Lord, I know the gospel is only good news if it gets there in time. God, I pray that you would use my family, the resources you have blessed me with, the ship on which I've been given to sail, my children, all of them. I want to give them to you for your kingdom. God, use us to do so much more than we ever thought was possible. We do this joyfully, Lord Jesus, not begrudgingly. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.